First of all, before I forget, my thanks to the British Council for paying my fare to get me out here and to get me back, to AIP and IEOST and COSA for funding my trip around Australia. And finally, thank you to you for coming to hear me talk about my favourite subject. I suppose it's my only subject these days, because I've, like Frankenstein, created a monster and it rules me now. I speak with some trepidation with people like Dr. Essex here, because I'm going to mention the Faraday and Doppler effects. But you must realise that, first and foremost, I am, or was, a schoolmaster, not a school teacher. I didn't guarantee to teach him anything, but I kept him under control. And I tried to get my kids to have a sound grounding in physics with the fundamentals, and unconsciously get them to learn scientific method, good scientific method. We weren't trying to turn out astronauts and cosmonauts. We were trying to turn out good engineers, scientists. We've even turned out doctors and dentists, one industrial spy. and so long as they did that job well, I felt quite rewarded. In fact, most of them have done far better than their teacher. The educational aspects of a satellite tracking station was the topic I used many years ago at Alexandra Palace for one of the Institute of Physics exhibition lectures, and it was published in the physics education issue from the Institute of Physics, and I'm going to leave a copy of that paper with Professor Cole at the end, because I have no further use for it in Australia, because there's going to be nothing else educational about my trip. But in there are some of the diagrams of the slides that I will use. There's also on the front a flow chart showing how physics and satellite tracking interacts with various other things. In biology, you've got the life sciences, you've got manned space flight. In chemistry, you've got the rocket fuel to put the things up there. And if you look at that, you'll realise that everything is a branch of physics, which of course it is. The first slide is a picture of the ascent stage of Apollo 9, and I show this, or I used to show this, after we'd done Leslie's cube experiment. I don't know whether you do it in Australia, but it's a copper cube full of boiling water. We keep it going with an immersion heater, because a Bunsen burner underneath isn't all that good. It has a polished face, a rough face, a white face, and a black face. And by standing a thermopile at one matchbox thickness away from each of those faces in turn and displaying it on a scale amp galvanometer, you could look at the emissivities of the various surfaces. And you can then go on and say, well, this does have application in passive thermal control on satellites. And that isn't just silver paper to wrap it up for Christmas. That is a thermal blanket to reflect the solar radiation from the engine of the ascent stage, because you don't want that to go before you want to come back from the moon. We then move on to a British satellite called Ariel, that is Ariel 1, and I used to point out these black and white stripes on here, which weren't put there for Newcastle United, but were to give some sort of active or passive thermal control by having a gold-plated body but with the black and white patches actually balancing up the thermal characteristics. And they're beginning to see that there is something in Leslie's cube after all. Now, in 1970, I think it was, we launched our one and only satellite from Woomera. This was the Prospero satellite, launched on Black Arrow. And this was an experimental satellite which carried calorimeters. And these calorimeters here were blocks of copper. And these blocks of copper had thermocouples attached to the back, and they were painted with different sample surfaces. There was a black surface and a gold surface, and there's crown and dulux and all the other various kinds of white paint, the idea being trying to find out which would be the right paint to use for the next satellite, which never came along. So this was just put in to show you my sort of philosophy about it, that although all the tracking work and the monitoring work at school was extracurricular, the kids used to work before. They used to come in at school about 8:15 in the morning, and lessons didn't start until 9:00, and they'd operate through the lunch hour, which was an hour and a half, which is just one orbital period of a cosmos. They'd use 3 half-hour shifts there, and they would also work at weekends and in holidays if there was anything really exciting going on. What we did was to milk the space programs as hard as we could for anything which would actually bring the real physics teaching to life. I mean, Leslie's Cube, let's face it, is a pretty boring piece of apparatus, but if you can tie it to something going to the moon or a British satellite, then it has some real meaning. I only obtained this slide 2 weeks ago. I became aware of it, and I wanted a copy of this for my daughter, who's carrying on the family business teaching physics at Malvern Girls College. Because when I saw that, something immediately occurred to me. Now, I wonder if anything immediately occurs to you. Does anybody recognise anything there from school physics? A sort of a wet subject? Does it? It's a ripple tank, isn't it? It's a ripple tank with diffraction at an obstacle. And if you look, you can see these fringes from this obstacle. You have here plane waves. The wavelength 200 metres, incident from the west, from the Atlantic, onto the island of Fula, F-O-U-L-A, which is off the Hebrides in Scotland. And here is diffraction at an obstacle on a grand scale. And that's another place when you've mucked about with your ripple tanks and mopped up the floor and things like that. If you put this on the screen, then you can really see diffraction taking place. It's even better than the reservoir just outside Northampton, which has a conduit through the causeway, and you get plane waves incident on the west side of the conduit and sort of semicircular waves coming out the pipe at the other end. And we always used to encourage the kids to cycle 10 miles to look at the biggest ripple tank in Northamptonshire. So this is yet another indication. That is from CSAT. This was the satellite that the Americans launched to look at the ocean surface, and it failed after about 6 or 7 weeks. It was a great tragedy, actually, and yet it was a benefit because it's given people a lot of time to analyse the results they got in that time. Nasty people said it was so good that they destroyed it, but it does. It shows airfields, it shows all sorts of interesting things. But I think it must have been the Tuesday before I flew out to Australia on the Friday, Dr. Horton of the Meteorological Office was doing a lecture at the Royal Society, and he'd got a slide showing the wake of the NATO fleet at exercise. You can see the V-shaped wakes. And then the Royal Aircraft Establishment at Farnborough Remote Sensing Department, once they digitised these, they treated it and actually produced side views of ships 9, 10, 11 and 12 in false colours, and you could actually see the sizes of the ships and the numbers of funnels. I don't know how they did that, but I wasn't able to get those in time to bring to Australia. Perhaps if somebody invites me back next time, I might have them. Hint, hint. Now, this is where I go into the Doppler effect. The reason I started listening to satellites, apart from the general interest of being able to hear something that I'd been looking at, was that I wanted one recording only to illustrate the Doppler effect on a grand scale in the sixth form. Now, Christmas 1957, I heard a recording of Sputnik 1, recorded by John Osborne at Stowe School, and he played it at the Science Masters Association annual meeting. And I said, "Oh, that's good, John, will you send me a copy?" And he said, "Yes," and he didn't. So when our chemist died, and the new chemist happened to be a radio ham, G3FOZ, I realised that here was someone with the means to let me listen to something and actually get a recording. And we actually missed the chance of recording Sputnik 3 because we didn't realise it was still transmitting. And the Russians spent the whole of 1959 shooting at the moon, missing it, hitting it, going around the back and photographing the hidden side. And it wasn't until May 1960 when they launched Sputnik 4, the first unmanned test of a Vostok, that we tried to get signals and were successful at the first attempt in about 4:15 in the morning, British summertime. We picked up our first signals. I've known lots of other people who've tried to get satellite signals and have perhaps, in the case of Sven Grahn, waited a year and a half before he got them. I don't think I would have been that patient, but we were lucky, we picked up our signals, and at the end of a week, having survived headlines in the local paper like "Local Men Follow Spaceship," we put the apparatus away and we had the recording, which I will play you now. No, it isn't, it's a different one. Before I go play that recording, let's try and tell you what I think the Doppler effect is. I think it is the change in frequency which is observed by a stationary observer distant from a moving source. Now, the usual thing was to talk about a train going through the station. Well, you get one musical tone of Doppler with a train going through the station. You can bring it up to date these days, because trains don't have steam whistles in England these days, and talk about Grand Prix racing. We used to have an earphone connected to an oscillator at a kilohertz and whirl it round our heads on about 6 feet or 2 metres of flex. It's the same sort of thing you get when you're flying control line aircraft and you're outside the circle. You hear the Doppler effect, the man on the inside holding the plane doesn't. Another illustration of the Doppler effect, I don't know whether this is well known in Australia, it wasn't well known in Western Australia. If you get a tap with a thin stream of water coming out of it and you just insert a pinpoint in it, you can actually see capillary waves with short wavelengths on one side and long wavelengths on the other. And that's a visual Doppler effect, and you can actually project it if you put it through the focal plane of a projector. I commend it to you, because it's nice to see a Doppler effect. You can also get it if you photograph a swan vertically swimming. You've got short waves in front of it and long waves behind it. However, we've got to go a bit careful, because you people have got it back to work, haven't you? Oh, I didn't want that. I'll go there. I wanted the focus. I hate lecturers whose slides aren't in focus. The man in the song, "The Railroad Runs Through the Middle of the House," gets the best Doppler effect. Except he only gets it that far, usually. You get a rapid change there. The further you get from the line of motion, the more the Doppler effect gets smeared out like that. And by measuring the time of the point of inflection, you can get a time of closest approach to your ground station. And by measuring the slope at the point of inflection, you can determine the slant range in a straight line. I don't believe in refraction in the ionosphere. The slant range from your station to the satellite. And then, if you believe in Pythagoras and a flat Earth, you can calculate from the orbital period the height of the satellite, the mean height of the satellite. You know the hypotenuse. That gives you the ground range of the sub-satellite point from your station. You can draw a circle of that radius around Kettering, and you can draw the common tangents to that circle and the line of latitude of the inclination of the satellite, and you've got four possible tracks. And this is the way we found the Chinese launch site when they launched their satellite in 1970, because we waited for the next pass, and we then were able to rule out some of the tracks because the Doppler effect was either more or less, I forget now. But I'm a great believer in flat Earth and Pythagoras and non-refraction in the ionosphere. It puts you in the right area. It got us into China anyhow, which is a good thing. The next slide shows another bit of physics. This is from the recording, which I will play you, of a pass of Cosmos 40 back in 1964. We are now up to Cosmos 1801. And I see John Coleman here, who was there last night. I said that I wouldn't be at all surprised if the Russians had launched on Friday. They did, and they did it on a grand scale. They launched 8 satellites with 1 rocket for tactical communications, but it took us past the 1,800 mark. Down the side here, you see drawings of an oscilloscope screen for the frequency measurement. This was another thing that we did at school. We set up a circular time base using a resistance and a capacitor, and we modulated the intensity grid with the signal. Now, if you start at the bottom, if you have a time base of 200 hertz, that goes around 200 times a second. If you put a 200 hertz signal on it, it will suppress the trace for one half of that. You could tell women's institutes and rotary clubs that for half a cycle it's a cathode ray tube and works well, and the other half of the cycle it's an anode ray tube and it doesn't work at all. But you wouldn't tell physics students that, because they might put it in their examination papers. But it does give a very precise frequency measurement, because when the frequency is about 210, this will rotate, that circular arc will rotate clockwise or anti-clockwise, according to how you've got it fixed up, at 10 times a second, and it gradually slows down and then reverses as it goes through 200, and then it sort of disappears and goes into a circle. So that is a very precise method of measuring the frequency, and all it needs is an oscilloscope and a signal generator, oscillator. I sometimes play a tape recording with a film, a 16mm film, showing what the oscilloscope trace did, and by leaving it on 200, when you've got a kilohertz of signal, you get 5 arcs. At 800, you get 4 arcs, 3 arcs, 2 arcs. I don't need to tell you that. This is what it sounds like. And instead of musical tone, you get a whole octave. Starts up here and down there. Not a very good recorder. But we're now starting to come down. I think even a tone deaf person would tell that the frequency's dropping. And of course, when we get here, it's the closest approach to Kettering. That's where Kettering is. Notice that the intensity is not constant. There is fading there. So there, we suggest, is a very dramatic demonstration of Doppler shift. It's even more dramatic if you've got a receiver in your classroom and you can actually get a signal like that during the lesson. Trouble is, we don't get many signals like that these days. They're usually modulated with information. And I've tried my hardest to get NASA to put a shortwave beacon on the shuttle. It wouldn't be a lot of problem in that, and it could be NASA's gift to the educationalists around the world, because with shuttle flights, as they were, going fairly regularly and not staying up too long, you could have measured the Doppler shift, you could have determined orbital periods, you could have got Faraday fading, all sorts of interesting things. We did try in the early days, we suggested that we would have one of the getaway special canisters and put a shortwave transmitter in it, but NASA said no, nobody's going to transmit out of our getaway special canisters. So I keep working, I keep grinding away at people like Phil Culberts, and I had a go at Charlie Taylor, the NASA representative in Canberra, the other day, but he says he doesn't even get communication from Washington, so I've got great hopes on that one. The next tape recording that I'm going to play deals with the fading that we heard. And that, as everybody here knows, is Faraday fading. I used to demonstrate the Faraday effect in the lab using a small piece of flint glass between the poles of an electromagnet, and with luck I got something like 6 degrees of rotation out of it. But you've just heard several 360N rotations in degrees on that one there. This is a six-pen recording produced at the University of College of Wales at Aberystwyth. And being a Welsh pen recorder, time goes that way. And here you see the seconds markers on there. This is from Explorer 22, or Beacon B. You can tell it's Beacon B because there's a 3 dB depression in the signal every 20-odd seconds. Explorer C, or Beacon C, or Explorer 27, had a double depression there for identification purposes. And what we see here are 2 traces from the 20.005 megahertz signal, first of all on an east-west dipole and then on a north-south dipole. And it should be quite obvious to people that the minima of this trace coincide with the maximum of that trace, which in fact does show that it is a rotation effect. So there is a rotation. And if you look at the top, we have a 41 megahertz signal and a 40 megahertz signal. And if you notice that this minimum coincides with that maximum, this minimum coincides with that maximum, and we have 1, 2, 3, 4 fades there. And that shows you that the Faraday fading is inversely proportional to the square of the frequency, because it's double the frequency. So by just looking at that, there's some interesting information to be obtained just from a six-pin recording. This is another interesting one, which shows that if you combine the east-west signal with the north-south signal, you don't get a straight line, which might suggest that their antennae weren't exactly at right angles. I don't know. Aberystwyth has always been pretty quiet about that trace. This recording here, listen to the fading here. I call that fast fading. And this is at the beginning of a transit. It's slowing down a bit. 20 megs again. You don't get that from your geosynchronous satellites. And I'll save you the bit in the middle, but this is as it goes away. Much slower. You'll have to take my word for it, that was the same pass. Right. Now my kids always used to think this was quite amazing, that by listening to this you could tell which way it was going, even when you couldn't see it. This is another one of ABBA's pen recordings of Beacon B, a full pass, and again you can see you have fast fading at the beginning and much slower fading towards the end. Let's see if I can sharpen that up, because otherwise you'll think that Aberystwyth can't produce good pen recordings, and they can. Yeah. This was just a trace which happened accidentally, and they were going to throw it away. I said, don't throw it away, there's good physics in that. Because you can explain why you are getting this fast and slow fading. When the satellite is to the south of Kettering, I'm sorry you're in Australia because your magnetic field lines don't go the same way as ours, but that's Kettering. When the satellite is to the south, the ray path is more or less along the magnetic field vector towards the antenna, and with the piece of glass in the line of the magnetic field, you get rapid Faraday rotation. When the satellite is passed to the north, as it did on that occasion, the ray path now comes almost perpendicular to the magnetic field vector, and so you get very, very slow fading. So by just deciding whether the fading is fast or slow at the beginning or the end, if it's in a polar orbit, you can tell which way the thing is going. And again, that has been very useful to us in picking up Russian satellites in the early days when we didn't know whether we got a northbound pass or a southbound pass. This brings me to what I call the interesting part, because I've got the rotten physics out of the way. This is the telemetry from the first Chinese satellite. Repeat. Seconds of propaganda. The Chinese wanted the world to know they got it up. They chose a frequency which was only 1 kilohertz away from the Soyuz frequency. 5 seconds to get its breath back. Ten seconds of silence. 5 seconds to get its breath back. Did that for a month. Were we glad when the batteries ran out? Now, we were very fortunate in picking up the telemetry, or the signals from this, the first people in the Western world to do it. I had a phone call one Saturday afternoon, and the voice said, do you want to know about this Chinese satellite? And I thought, it's one of my sixth form having me on, you see. So I said, who is it? He said, Dick Pankhurst, Evening Telegraph. I said, oh yes, Dick, what about it? He says, it's playing music. I says, what? He said, yeah, I know the frequency. I said, right, tell me the frequency, which he did, 20.009. I said, well, I'll call you back. Now, Murphy's law is that you've probably missed all the passes for about 5 or 6 hours, so I got Mrs. Perry to pack me up some buns and a flask of coffee and things like that, and I put some marking together and took it up to the school, and inside 20 minutes picked this up. 4 minutes before Sven Grahn got it in Sweden, because it came our way first. And we had our recording, like that you heard there, played on the radio and the television news. And because of that, we were invited to the Institute of Physics annual soiree at the Savoy Hotel. And the boys hired their dinner suits from Moss Bros, and we had a very good dinner. And I realised that there were going to be lots of clever people there, people like Patrick Blackett, as president of the Royal Society, and they were going to say, what does it mean? And we didn't really know. So after we'd had the invitation at the physics practical on the Friday, we set about measuring the frequencies of the notes in the tune, because I decoded that with our piano that night, and like this, and we suddenly realised that the key to this telemetry lay in the tune, because the 100% value is the frequency of that note there, and we were still tied up with 32 quantization from our Russian satellites. We assumed that this was quantized in 32 bits, and it isn't. The zero value is the frequency of the lowest note in the tune. Here we have calibration, 100, 0, 50, 0, 100. That is a double-length channel, and the length of one channel of scientific telemetry is the length of one crotchet, one black note. So the key to the science all lies in the tune. If you plot the values of that one, and that one against time, you get three sine waves 120 degrees out of phase with each other. So those particular channels give you X, Y, and Z for the attitude of the satellite. What the other values are, we don't know, but we thought we'd done quite well to get that far. I took a chance and wrote a letter to the editor of Nature, thinking that school teachers never get letters published in Nature, and he published it within about 3 weeks, so I was quite happy about that. The first Chinese satellite looks like that. That is a half-scale model at the Paris Air Show, and show you the other sorts of things which you can do. If you measure the length of the shortwave rib antenna and the length of that spike on there, you can reason that it's going to transmit on 180 megs as well as on 20 megs. And this year, on the 6th of October, by tuning 180 megs, not quite 180 megs, I picked up the signals from the 19th Chinese satellite before it had done two orbits. We announced that on the Teletext service of independent television as an ITN scoop. Chinese launched 19th satellite. It will be recovered on Saturday. The Chinese didn't announce that they launched it until the 11th of October when they recovered it. So between the 6th and the 11th, I kept getting phone calls saying, is there really a Chinese satellite? And I say, oh yes, if you'd rung 5 minutes ago, you'd have heard it go by. However, by just measuring antennae, you can do some quite simple things, and you can get in resonance and all sorts of other physics like that. This is tedious, this, because it goes on for over a minute. But this is the sort of telemetry we get from the Soyuz spacecraft, or we used to get from the Soyuz spacecraft. It's pulse duration modulation. And you will hear, and if you count, there are 29 pulses there. That is a synchronising train of pulses, which does several things. First of all, it marks the start of the telemetry frame of 15 bleeps or 15 words. Secondly, it gives you a measure, because there's a gap for three more pulses, which gives you the 32, which is 2 to the n, and you can work out n, with which to measure the length of these bleeps. And another thing that it does is it provides various pieces of information. So if you listen carefully, I will count you through this tedious recording. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5... long. Right. didn't bother to count until it goes brrr again. But the next time, this one will be 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Oh, that was a short one. I've gone past it. That's all right. There was a short one there. Now we're going to get 2 more of those because it was short for a minute. And then it will go to medium. 1, 2, 3, 5. What you've got to do is to get condition yourself to realise that medium is longer than short in a minute. Also, wait for the break. Not for a commercial. That's caused by pulling the jack plug out exactly on the minute so you know where the time is on your tape. Now that was the medium one, you see. And why, you say, does that sort of thing happen? Well, we didn't know. With Soyuz 3 and Soyuz 4, word 8 had always been medium. It wasn't until Soyuz 5 that we got this 1 minute of medium, 1 minute of long, 1 minute of short, 1 minute like this, you see. So there was obviously a threeness about Soyuz 5. And Soyuz 5 had 3 men in it, whereas all the others had only had one. And this was, as it says there, biomedical subcommutation. Before we go on to that, let me point out that when they quantize their data to send it back, they logarithmically amplify it. If you remember what a slide rule looks like, if you've got a small value, it stretches out the small values to something reasonable, and the long value stops you going over the far end. So it goes through a logarithmic amplifier before it's quantized and telemetered. Now, we were a bit perplexed about this, but we realized that if you had 3 men and you wanted to see how they were healthy, we were looking for heart rate. In fact, we found respiration rate. You would need 3 channels. But, I mean, a guy isn't suddenly going to die in 2 minutes, is he? So the Russians got around this by using word 8 to show which cosmonaut they were monitoring and word 4 to show what his respiration rate was. And that they saved a channel. The day after they launched Soyuz 5, we noticed something else. We noticed that 6 and 7, which are always short, suddenly on Soyuz 4, word 7 was very long. We actually got a Great Northern Telegraph Company Limited Undulator Mark II from the Post Office Museum about 4 days before they launched these 2 Soyuz. And so we were able to see the bleeps, which was a new order of magnitude. It moved us up a gear. And we didn't know what was happening. We hadn't got a clue. This was at 09:32, just after it had gone by. At 11:20, when it came round again, we suddenly found that in Soyuz 4, we were getting the long, short, medium, long, short, medium sequence. So whereas we'd only had one man, Shatalov, in Soyuz 4, we'd now got 3 men in Soyuz 4 and only one man in Soyuz 5. Now, we didn't see them go, but we knew that they'd actually transferred. And this was before the Russians announced that they'd done it. And then an hour and a half later at 12:45, this was back to normal. Short, short, and again the consecutive sequences. And when the Russians said what had happened, they said that they had depressurized the orbital module, climbed out, pulled themselves across in open space, and gone into the depressurized module of Soyuz 4, and that told us that this was the orbital module pressure, or rather the orbital module vacuum, because a very long pulse here is a very high vacuum, and a short normal pulse is here means actual normal pressure. And I could go on about this, but I won't, because it's pretty boring, really. The next signal I want to play you is from the second Chinese satellite, which when we first heard it, we tuned out as interference, but later logged as horse's hooves. There's a triple click every 5 seconds. Now, the Chinese are fiendishly cunning people. This thing transmitted until it burned up for about 10 years. And In the pulse duration modulation, if you like to regard them as soccer goalposts, it's the length of the crossbar which is the measure of the word. But what does the crossbar do? It only keeps the uprights apart, so the Chinese just transmit the uprights. And here's the triple pulse, that's 1, 2, 3. This is the triple pulse every 5 seconds, and actually these are calibration, because if you look at the unmarked ones, they're equispaced. And they are the left-hand goalpost, or the start of the measurement. The ones which are numbered are the right-hand goalpost, and measures the actual duration. This is called pulse position modulation. And I've got a colleague in Malmo who's got remarkable ears. Now, I don't mean that they stick out like Dumbo, but he can hear telemetry changes in those clicks. And he wrote me a letter saying, I think that the telemetry changes when the satellite goes into eclipse. Well, I couldn't hear it, but I got recordings and I played them onto the pen recorder, and he was absolutely right. And here you can see it going into eclipse. If you look at word five, 5 seconds, 10 seconds, in 15 seconds has suddenly gone to a short value. This is what Janola heard. It upset the rhythm, I suppose. Word 10, 5, 10, 15, 20 seconds goes to a short value. And word 14, is it? No, 13, let's think. Yes, it's word 13. 5, 10, 15, 20, 25, about 30 seconds goes to a short value, because they're each 5 second strips. So, we said to ourselves, what should we do now? And came up with the idea that we should look for the opposite to happen when it came out of eclipse. But of course we had to wait about 2 months so that we were getting passes over Kettering when the thing exited from eclipse. And we looked, and lo and behold, word 4 went back to its long state. But words 10 and 13 didn't. Well, obviously, they'd got to go back somewhere, so we kept looking. And then one day, we saw words 10 and 13 very slowly recovering over a period of about 5 minutes. And this occurred 20 minutes after the satellite had left the eclipse. And it just so happened that day that I realised that it had been in eclipse for 20 minutes. So what happens is this. Word 4 is an optical sensor. When it goes short, it says, I've gone into the Earth's shadow. The brain inside the satellite says, I've gone into the Earth's shadow, I'm going to get cold. I will therefore put my jacket on. So what you see here on 10 and 13, you see the Chinese satellite putting its jacket on to stop itself getting cold. But of course, it does cool down even with its jacket on. When it comes out of the shadow, the optical sensor on word 4 says, ooh, goody, sunlight again, you see. But the brain says, ah, yes, but I've been cooling down for 20 minutes. And I'm not going to take my jacket off until I've warmed up again. And so it waits 20 minutes, and then, even so, it takes its time taking its jacket off. And when we got the pictures of the second Chinese satellite, we were delighted to see the solar panels on it. This is not a very good slide, actually. Probably would be better if it's darker, but still, not to worry. It's very similar. The difference between this and the other one is that it does have these little banks of solar panels, which is why it was able to transmit for about 10 years. But it doesn't have the active Venetian blind type louvres thermal control. Now, this was rather disconcerting because we'd written in one of the Library of Congress's reports that it had got active thermal control of a louvre type construction. And it wasn't until Sven Grahn was in Beijing earlier this year on business for the Swedish Space Corporation that he actually saw China 2, a backup model of it, and was allowed to look inside. And the louvres are on the end of a semicircle channel inside which contains the electronics. And that's only been referred to twice, in public, once in Perth, and today at La Trobe. Because inside there you have the electronics all in a semicircular sort of conduit with thermal louvres on the end. But it was nice to see that sort of thing happen. Have I nearly got to the end? No. Yes. Another recording. Russian spy satellite. Second generation spy satellite.
We tuned that out as Morse code interference. But then we realised, three revs later, it got a Doppler shift on it. And this is it slowed down. I wouldn't be surprised if I pulled something out here, because I'm not getting a... Or was that the last slide? Oh. Well, I didn't intend to go on with that. That's right. That's part of... Now, I've got six lectures to give in Australia, and I do mix the slides up. So we'll have the lights on, please. I'll just tell you quickly about that. Those Morse code groups, which we'll play them, you can hear them. Did-di-da, dit, did-di-dit. Did-di-da, dit, did-di-dit. That's a 3-1-3. Did-di-da, dit, did-di-dit. Did-di-da, U-E-S. Now that marks the beginning of the frame. You've got 1-3-1-3 group, and then you've got 11 2-3-2 groups like these. Did it, did it, did it, da, did. Did it, I, did it, did, S, da, did. I, S, N. That's a 2-3-2 group. And it seemed obvious that this would be binary code, and you put a naught with a dot and a one with a dash. And I lectured on this at Aberystwyth and Cardiff, one half term, and my daughter came with me, and we stopped at the Severn Bridge service area on the way home, and she said in her little innocence, "Aren't you embarrassed saying that you don't understand what that means?" And I said, "Yes." But the key lies in word 7, because word 7 is different every time the satellite comes round, and it sometimes changes while we're listening to it. So, with sort of daughter prompting, when I got back to school to start the next half of the term, I said to David Muggleton, "Look, David, take this last satellite and write out all the word 7s and then put the dots and dashes in again." Which he did, and as he was in the second sitting of dinner, when the bell went at 12:25, I walked up the back of the lab to see how he was getting on, and I looked at him across the bench, and I could see this thing changing by one, because the Russians, the rotten devils, transmit their binary backwards. The first bit is the least significant bit, and when now when you did that, you found that word 7 slowly increased through the flight. And word 7 actually was the exposure counter on their film reconnaissance camera. And they still, even with their, if you picked up the Russian RS amateur satellites, they transmit their binary backwards too, because they have groups of letters, which if you read them backwards in the binary, gives you a straightforward number. Now, sir, I have come to the end of my slides, as you can see. I do apologise for that. If there are any questions that you would like to ask me, I would be very happy to answer them. If you want to go home, I will not take offence. And thank you for listening and smiling politely, Dr. Essex, at the right point when I mentioned Faraday and Doppler. But don't be too cruel to me. Thank you. It's in the paper that I'm going to give Professor Cole. There is a well-known formula, which I don't know, which I've forgotten, which actually links the slope at that point to the slant range. What we do with that, because how you draw your... We use felt pens to draw our graphs, but how you draw the thing, it's a little bit inexact. But there's a French guy called Boudouris, wrote an article in Proc IEE early on, sort of back in the Sputnik 1-2 days, which said that you could treat that part of the curve as a cubic. And if you fit a cubic to it and differentiate it, you can actually get the... differentiate it twice, you can find the slope at the point of inflection. And that's what we used to do, and feed that into our formula. The time of closest approach, because we assumed that we received the signal instantaneously. It didn't take any time to get from the satellite to us. And with the accuracy that we were working, it didn't. And we didn't have to make a correction for relativity either, which is good, because I don't understand relativity. You mustn't look for anything clever in this, sir. This is what the RAF record backyard physics and backyard equipment. Oh, come on, there must be some more questions. Yes?
Sorry, can you just describe the sort of equipment that you're using at school for training?
Yeah, we started life with a Marconi CR-100, World War II receiver. This was a valve-type receiver, and it had a logging scale, and the BFO wasn't stable. So we used a ex-US Army BC-221 signal generator for two purposes. First of all, to locate the transmission frequency, and then to use it as an external BFO. And with that, we did all our work until 1967, when Ray Cowles and the Daily Express decided we'd had two world scoops in less than 12 months. It probably wasn't an accident, and they said, you could do with something better, couldn't you? And I said, yes, we could, and they gave us this. Because we used to have to hold the CR-100 there and do that to it to make it oscillate. I'll tell you another interesting little story. If there are any science teachers here, you won't believe this, but the Science Masters Association had a meeting at Cambridge. Oh, it must have been about 1965, I suppose. And in the Cavendish laboratory, they put out a tea chest full of old valves with a notice saying, help yourself. You can imagine what science teachers were like. They were sort of scrabbling all these valves and sticking them in their pockets. But Jeff sort of went along and he looked at these and he sort of was picking them up and seeing if there were any KTW61s there, because we couldn't get KTW61s on the surplus market in London. So he sort of... And a grey-haired gentleman, well, just turning grey, came along and said, tapped me on the shoulder, he says, you seem to know what you're looking for. I said, yes, but there aren't any here. He said, well, I've never seen science teachers putting anything back. What is it you're looking for? I said, oh, I'm looking for KTW61s. He said, well, come with me. And we went round the back and he gave me two dozen brand new box KTW61s. And that was Martin Ryle, who became Sir Martin Ryle, the Astronomer Royal, and got a Nobel Prize for the work on discovery of the pulsar. But he discovered me sort of putting valves back into a box. And it kept the CR-100 running. Now, after we got the RAYCAL, it removed all the uncertainty and preserved all the fun. We then looked to have a VHF capability. And from the Appleton Laboratory, or what was called the Radio and Space Research Station at Slough, we found an Edison 770R VHF receiver in their storeroom, which had done 25 years service in the Falklands, I think, and was just sort of on the shelf. So we had that on long loan. In fact, we still got it. Derek Slater's got that. And then you can see I sort of go around universities. The Clarendon Laboratory had an open day many years ago now. And they had all their transistorized, all singing, all dancing stuff laid out for people to look at, and I didn't understand it, because if they don't light up, they're not, can't be real radio components. I sort of looked in the cupboard and I saw the magic words, panoramic adapter. Now, I don't know anything about radio or electronics. I finished with a pentode. But Derek had been saying, oh, what we really need is a panoramic adapter. So I said to John Ward, I said, oh, so you've got a panoramic adapter. He said, yes, I've got the receiver to go with it. I said, have you? I said, can I have it? He said, sure. He said, but it doesn't work. And this was a Halicrafters RS-27, or S-27, the sort of radio that they put in an Anson aircraft and flew up and down the east coast of England to locate the frequency of the beams which the Germans were using to direct the Heinkel 111s to the Rolls-Royce works at Derby. It's that sort of vintage. And my daughter was with me, because she's a bit of a chip off the old block, and we lugged this stuff out, and we took it back home, and I said to Derek, I said, oh, I've got a panoramic adapter. I said, and I've got a receiver. I said, but it doesn't work. So he opened the top up, and he looked in it, and he said, those six valves are all the same. He says, if we change the front one with the back one, it might work. And it did! And it's still working today, because when I retired in 1984, I told the Clarendon Laboratory I had no further use for this, and an Oxford school teacher came and collected it and took it away, and I think it is still tracking satellites in Oxford. Now, there was no way in which I could take a piece of equipment about twice the size of this home when I retired. My wife had said, you're not having that in here, you know. So I paid 140 quid for a little Japanese scanner, an AOR 2001. cost $900 Australian now your dollar's slid. And there's a better thing called a 2002 which has a knob on it which you can turn, because mine only tunes in 5 kilohertz steps. So what I use at the moment, I use the Raycal with a piece of blue wire out the window to a nearby tree, and the distance is the distance between the tree and the house. And I use the AOR 2001 with a preamp and a 60 centimetre whip indoors on my desk, and that's all I use. Is it getting complicated now, is it?
No, interacting with the Americans, I suppose, and the European space people, but have the Soviets and the Chinese ever contacted you?
Well, the Chinese sent me that picture of China too.
Yes.
Yes, they know what we do. And the Soviet Union, I used to write to Boris Petrov, who was the head of the Intercosmos program, and unfortunately he died, and I never did take up with Katonikov. Boris was all right, he used to acknowledge the stuff we sent him, but when they launched the second Intercosmos satellite, we didn't pick up the signals, and I wrote to him asking for the frequency, and he deliberately misunderstood it. He said it would be very difficult to add another ground station at this late stage of the program. But I didn't want to switch it on and off, I wanted just to listen to it. No, they know what we do. I mean, I meet them at international exhibitions, and they're well aware of our work. And if they don't want me to listen, they would change their frequencies and dump their transmissions into the middle of the Soviet Union in the same way that the Americans dumped theirs into Pine Gap. you don't get many Russian trawlers near Pine Gap. Now I've stirred it up, yes. I don't know what Pine Gap is. It's just a buzzword that you drop and make Australians laugh. I used to think it was near Ayers Rock. That shows you how much I know. I actually think it's pretty important. What is Pine Gap? I should imagine that satellites which transit down over the Soviet Union dump information into Pine Gap where the Russians can't intercept it. It's then sort of beamed up and across the other side. I mean, it makes sense there. So I would think it's important. And the only way that you can intercept that sort of stuff is by having your own satellite sitting up there and trying to intercept from up on top what's going down below. Well, they've got it, haven't they? They got it with what is... Oh, you're thinking of TDRS. Yeah, well, TDRS, the first one was launched and didn't really make the right orbit, but because it had got so much fuel on it, because they hadn't taken it off when one of the customers dropped out, they were able to nudge it and sort of gradually boosted up to the right sort of orbit. It was a very good engineering feat. The second TDRS was lost in the Challenger explosion. And so the first payload for the shuttle when it flies again, theoretically on the 18th of February 1988, will be TDRS 2, which was in fact TDRS 3. And eventually they will have another TDRS, so they'll have three of these TDRS, TDERS, tracking and data relay satellite. But that is a NASA satellite. Now there's also another system of what I call American Molniers, which fly in the semi-synchronous orbit, the highly elliptical orbits, and these are called the SDS system, the satellite data system. And the KH-11 spy satellites, which do digital imagery return, and if you come to my talk tonight I will show you a couple of KH-11 pictures, they communicate through the satellite data system satellite over the Arctic back down to the National Reconnaissance Agency in America, I believe. But the Americans don't issue any data on those now. They are part of their very classified mission. But you see, it's very difficult to hide a satellite dish. And there are dishes in the United Kingdom which look to the northwest and look to the northeast. And if you can imagine down here, they'd be looking to the southeast and the southwest. There aren't many geosynchronous satellites to the southeast and southwest of Australia. And likewise, there aren't many geosynchronous satellites to the northeast and northwest of the United Kingdom. So it's very difficult to hide a dish. And if once, see, you can't tell where they are. You can get the as and the el from that. But we've got a secret station not far from where I live in Cornwall, in my holiday place. And I saw them build it. And I gave a lecture to what was called the RE Symposium. It's the navigating branch of the Royal Air Force. And the head of MI6 was there. And I put up a nice picture on the screen, taken at dusk, of one of these big 85-foot dishes with aircraft warning lights on, and said, this is an interesting thing. And I used a view graph, and I drew a map, and I said, this is Kilcampton Church, and this dish is looking at that direction there. And if you sort of draw a line around here, you can work out the azimuth of that dish. And if you know that it's looking at a geosynchronous satellite, there's only one height it can be over the equator, and a little bit of spherical trigonometry shows you this one is looking at the one over the Indian Ocean, and that's looking at the one at 14 degrees west over the Atlantic. And I sort of beamed at him. I said, but I don't think I should have told you that. I believe it's secret. Nothing is secret from me. If I can discover it, how can it be secret? No, we looked at orbital periods changing due to micro thrusters on the Russian ones, because the ones which drop their nuclear payloads over Canada, they make small micro manoeuvres to maintain station with each other and to keep their height at 265 kilometres. So when Andy Driver came to me in November 1977 and said, my satellite has stopped manoeuvring, I said, well, don't worry, lad, it'll soon move to the higher orbit. And he came a week later, he said, you know, it isn't manoeuvring. So I said, well, let me check your figures. And it wasn't. And we knew that this thing with the we thought it was radioactive power source for the radar satellite. We knew that it would come down sort of towards the end of March. But on the 6th of January, according to the Russians, a catastrophic event occurred when it was out of range of the Soviet Union. And it began to tumble. It lost its attitude. And as people in Western Australia know, when satellites tumble, they come down near Esperance. And this thing started to accelerate its decay and come down much earlier than March. And I was teaching one afternoon, and the telephone went, and I went out the back, and a voice said, this is UPI. Do you know anything about this satellite which has come down over Canada? I said, do you mean Cosmos 954? He said, yes, yes, how did you know? I said, well, we thought it was going to come down tomorrow. He said, you thought it was going to come down tomorrow? I said, oh yes, it's been in trouble since last November. Since last November? How long have you known? I said, since last November. Good God, he said, Mr. Trudeau didn't know till this morning. And that's a true story, but you probably won't believe it. I've had a great deal of enjoyment in pursuing my hobby. And thank you for listening to me and asking me to come to Australia. Thank you.